too.
So without further ado, I'd like to welcome our next panel and turn it over to Christopher Lydon.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you, Steve. This panel with three eminences really out of broadcasting, but specifically public broadcasting. I will turn it over to them. We're going to be fairly brief in the initial statements and then try to open things up for your questions and any kind of comment. It seems to me the underlying question in this moment is, especially for public broadcasting, is the internet the new public? What makes public broadcasting, and in the new century, what will justify public broadcasting's claim to that word public? Just by way of reference, I was thinking, and I grew up in Boston, and I grew up on public broadcasting, and I've been trying to think what made it public. It had almost nothing to do with the fact that there were a few tax dollars in there. To me, it had everything to do with the fact that WGBH, radio, and then eventually television came out of the both the industrial and the transcendental glory of 19th century New England. It had everything to do with the fact that the three sort of name founders of the station, at least out front, were Ralph Lowell, the greatest trustee in America in those days on 1,000 boards, also Cardinal Cushing, and Sidney Rabb, who had founded the Stop and Shop chain. But you had an eminent Catholic, Yankee, Protestant, and Jew, exactly like the Boston Braves outfield at that time. Sid Gordon, Sam Jethro, who was Catholic and black, and Willard Marshall. It had everything to do with the diversity of programming, which really was not to be found elsewhere. Things like Julia Child, Evening at Symphony, Bud Collins inventing television, inventing tennis on television. Innovation broadly in the public interest, a marvelous news guy who was interested in absolutely everything from poetry to the universe and happened to curate the Nieman Foundation on Journalism at Harvard, Louis Lyons. It was an aggressively non-commercial, anti-commercial voice with an incessant appeal to the grassroots for sustaining support. Okay, that's analog New England of a million years ago. We're now in the internet century, Stephen Colbert's world, radically transformed. Any one of us could go to Staples or Radio Shack this morning and come out on the spending of a few hundred dollars, come out a broadcaster, a podcaster, a writer, a speaker with global reach. The question is, what's the new role for public broadcasting? Is the internet extending its space? Is it co-opting its space? Is the internet the space? Is it waiting for public broadcasting to feed and fill that space? We'll go in alphabetical order for starters. Bill Buesenberg, one-time news director at National Public Radio, is now the news executive and conscience of Minnesota Public Radio and American Public Media. Bill Buesenberg.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Thank you. We've been asked to be really quick, so I'm going to move fast through a bunch of stuff, and I'm going to focus mostly on one thing. Minnesota Public Radio has been obsessed with user-generated content for quite a while. We have a whole bunch of things going on. The basic statistics, just let me give you the orientation. On the radio, we have about 900,000 listeners in Minnesota. That's Minnesota Public Radio. Nationally, American Public Media has about 15 million listeners around the country. The web, yeah, we're above a million on a regular basis monthly now of unique browsers. We're sending out something over 4 million email newsletters every month with our various programs. So there's a lot going on, and I urge you to take a quick look at the website sometime and dig in there. I'm going to talk mostly about public insight journalism, and there is a video, a six-minute video, which is also on the site if you go to the PIJ part of the site. One of the new things we started just very recently, we did a mini wiki, and what this is a free music encyclopedia for our region. We started it up with about 20 articles or so, and we now have 1,000 different articles of people talking about bands and musicians and history, and it goes all the way from classical, which we have a very rich classical history in Minnesota, all the way to polka and jazz and rock and everything in between. This one happens to be on Bob Dylan, a kind of local guy who did well. Okay, that's MiniWiki. This is Gather. I'm not going to really talk a whole bunch about it, but gather.com, you may have heard about it. Tom Gerace is here this afternoon. He knows all about it. We have more people in the audience who know about it. But it is generating, there's about 25,000 subscribers now using it on a regular basis, creating sites, creating all kinds of content. This one happens to be Minnesota Life, where you go in there and there's all kinds of pictures and postings and people talking about and creating things around that. That's gather.com, which is sort of a sister project going on connected to Minnesota Public Radio. What I'm really going to talk about is PIJ, as we call it. And we've also created CIJ, which is a Center for Innovation in Journalism, as an umbrella to run this effort. It's something we've been doing for 3 years, working hard at it, and I want to kind of give you an overview. Here's where we started. Bill Kling, the president of NPR and APM, gets credit for this notion, which we all have, I think, that if you have, okay, in the case of the news station, I've got about 500-some thousand, more than 500,000 listeners. Gee, they're a lot smarter on a lot of things than we are. What if we turned our newsroom around from being inside and trying to do stories from, you know, as the gatekeeper, and took it outside to the audience and let them tell us things? So here's what we've done. We've basically created a database of listeners who are willing to give us information. This is the Public Insight Repository. We have about 18,000 people now on a regular basis, and we know who they are. They've given us the information about what they do, what they're interested in, even, you know, their income level, and it goes from CEOs to masseuses. It goes from social workers to all kinds of people are on this database. The bottom line here, these bottom three lines, that's the normal newsroom, right? You just create stories and you put them on the web and you give them to the audience. What we've created is this top layer. We now take our database and we write to them on a regular basis. Let's say we're doing healthcare. We know there are about 900 people in the database immediately that are nurses, doctors, people who are interested in healthcare, have knowledge about healthcare. We can write to them as we have and said, we're doing a series on the new insurance. Give us your information along these questions. It's an open-ended question. We get back hundreds of emails that comes to these group of analysts. There are now two of them in the newsroom. They're going to go through those emails and basically give to the reporters the information they need to do a really good story. The reporters are very skeptical to start with. Oh my, why do we have to do this? They are not skeptical any longer because they're getting tremendous information back. This is like a revolution in a Rolodex in some ways, and they get that. An example. You do a normal economic story, you go talk to the experts, and you say, what's going on? And then you go out and maybe you go to the mall and do a Vox Pop and get some examples of what they say is going on. Public insight journalism turns that on its head. We've done a bunch of economic stories that have really been different. What do? We write to our database, tell us your economic story. What's happening in the economy? Are you crunched in the middle? What's going on? We get back hundreds of emails from people who will tell us their story. The reporter suddenly says, gosh, I have a map of what's happening in the economy. He's going through that with the analysts. We're finding all kinds of people, all kinds of stories. We then take that to the economists and say, here's what we're finding out. And we get really interesting stories. And so instead of a one-part series, we did a five-part series on this. This was just one recent one we've done. And we're doing this all the time. It's getting in information, stories, people, ideas that the newsroom didn't know was out there until we started asking and using the web. Northwest Airlines, the biggest employer in the state of Minnesota, Northwest, as some people say, but they're in bankruptcy and they've been on strike, and there's a whole lot of stories around this. Our coverage has been smarter and better because of public insight journalism. We have a database that includes people who fly, obviously, people who work at the airline, FAA inspectors, FBI people. We have gotten stories from all of those kinds of people giving us information about how to cover this strike and bankruptcy, and information that has gone into stories. We have broken bunches and bunches of stories using the database to start the discussion about this and what's happened. Here's a typical one. You know, we write a letter out. The question was, how has the Northwest labor dispute affected you? And we get back, here's someone who worked at the airline for 15 years. It's the kind of thing that happens all the time that we go through. We created an idea generator. This is a different way to get information in, but it works extremely well. We were doing a series on the education achievement gap, huge problem in Minnesota as it is in many places, between minority and white students, what's happening. We asked people to tell us what is happening, why it's happening, and what you think could be done about it. Or again, hundreds of things come in. People get to see what others have written. They get to rank them. We get to do a story based on this information. And we did a whole series of stories. Then we held a town hall meeting. We invited 200 people who had the best ideas. They came to this meeting along with all of the heads of the school districts. And we had an evening, a two-hour discussion about it. And, of course, we edited that down to an hour and put that on the radio as well as on the web. So we're using people's ideas to really help us cover. We did another one on the future of small towns. Not a big story maybe in the metro area, but in most states, small towns are dying in all kinds of ways. We're looking for the ideas that are going in the other direction. We asked people to tell us in Minnesota. We got hundreds and hundreds of suggestions from people. Here's what we're doing in our town, and that other people in other towns were going, oh, and they're voting on it, and they're saying, this is great. We like this. We like this. Of course, it was a series of stories. Then, of course, we did a big day-long symposium with the University of Minnesota, bringing in the people with the best ideas to talk about this. So we're, in a way, again, the audience is informing us about small towns. And, oh, by the way, we're informing reporters about this, too. And the reporters say, gee, we know so much more about this. It's so much different than I thought it was. And we find people so interestingly. We also are creating simulations of various kinds. I'm just going to cite two. This is the budget balancer. We've done it a couple of times. Okay, the state had a big deficit a couple of years ago in the billions, and then the other time it was only in the hundreds of millions. But there's a deficit. We let people come in, go through the state budget, and make choices. Where do you want to raise taxes? Where do you want to cut taxes? And then up pops a little thing. It's kind of like a game, and it says, oh, by the way, you just eliminated, you know, kindergarten through sixth grade if you do that. You really wouldn't want to do that. But they get to see what are the choices. The results of this, several things happened. The first one, we had about 11,000 people use it. And it's a complicated, it takes about 20, 25 minutes to go through it. So this is not simple. Maybe this only works in Minnesota where people do care about education and the budget a lot, but they go through it. They can email their results to their state representative. They can email the results to the governor. Of course, we see what the results are. We get the emails, of course, and we know who these people are coming in. They are using this budget balancer, and what we hear from the state legislature is, golly, I have so many more better informed constituents giving me information because they understand the trade-offs that we have to make, and they see it. We are able to see I've highlighted syntaxes on here because we saw all of the choices people were making aggregated. Gee, they seem to be raising those tobacco taxes and liquor taxes a whole lot. Seemed to be the easiest thing to do. So we did a series of stories based on that, and it turns out that's, in fact, what the state governor did as well. He saw that as the easiest way to balance the state budget. That's what happened. We felt we were ahead of the news by doing that. We did a very recent one on medical matchmaker. Medical insurance is a huge issue. We help people go through it. What are the choices you can make? What would happen in your case? What maybe should you do? And this was part of a big healthcare series. Was a big project, and the information we got in was terrific. It was, people used this. It wasn't quite as good a game as we wanted because it's a little tough to do, but again, we had hundreds and hundreds of people using it, thousands of people using it. Okay, here's where we are now. About 18,000 people, and it's growing. We get people from all over the country because we're starting to roll this out nationally. It's small right now, but we're investing in the staff that does it. We can say well over 100 stories or projects have come out of this for the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. The newsroom will tell you they've gone from skepticism to saying, you know, so much knowledge resides in our audience. We are crazy not to be using this and using it all the time and using it really well. So it has turned the newsroom around in many ways. Here's how we get people in the network. We use the radio as the Barker channel sometimes. We send out targeted emails. You know, we have the help us cover it buttons on stories. We've done these simulations I talked about. We've gone to the state fair. We have community meetings where we talk about this. We're trying to expand the network all the time. You'll see little, you go places and there's a, you know, help us cover the stories, share what you know, things people register. And once they understand that this is information that stays in the newsroom, it's not used by the fundraisers, it's not used by any other part of the company, these are news sources. So it's inside the firewall. And we're collecting this and we're doing it, and they understand, they want to help us, they want the news media to do a much better job. So we thank people, by the way, which is very important. After they've given us information and we're using it in stories, we send back a thank you and we tell them when the story's on and we give them a link. They can listen to it on the web. That completes the loop, and they feel they're part of our process going through. We're talking about using it nationally already. We're doing some things with Marketplace, our documentary unit, American Radio Works. We have different projects going. We had to tiptoe into this because when you start on Marketplace has 8 million listeners. When you start saying, you know, come tell us this, you want to be careful that you can handle it all. So we're tiptoeing into it. But we now have the software that we can handle this kind of volume and be able to look and find things and make it work. So we have a news analyst for PIJ out in California working with Marketplace. We also want to give this away in some form. That's if we can actually find the foundation support to help us, because we want to make this transportable, like the idea generator. It could be used anywhere. Why not? The budget balancer. Other states are going through things like that. Why not? We want to make it transportable and usable. Here's a number of stations in the public radio world who have expressed great interest. We're making presentations, talking to them, want to use it with them. So it's a way to get it out in the public radio world. We think in the newspaper world. We think in all kinds of ways. You know, MSM needs to change badly, and we think this is one of the possible ways it could work. We created this Center for Innovation in Journalism at our new building. We're trying to create a way to train people on this, use it. We're doing that more and more. That's it. I did it in your little limited time, and I'll be happy to take questions later, or now, or whenever.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Bill. Terry Heaton spent more than a quarter of a century in television. It did not ruin him somehow. He's a new media consultant without the gobbledygook from Nashville. Terry Heaton.
Thank you. I want to start by saying that when I go into, I'm a consultant, I work with commercial broadcasters. When I go into a boardroom with a bunch of people, they're all sitting around, they've got their notepads, and they're waiting for me to tell them what to do. And so the first thing that comes out of my mouth is, listen. And I tell you that because that's counterintuitive to broadcasters. And as Jamie Boyle said, you know, everything about this is counterintuitive. And asking broadcasters to listen is a new skill because they're not in the listening business. Well, that's not my business model. I'm going to talk to you about what I think is my best client, WKRN-TV in Nashville. They're an ABC affiliate owned by Young Broadcasting. The general manager, Mike Seacrest, is a forward thinker, and he has found some money to do some things. And the first rule of the Internet in doing anything is that it's always in beta. You know, the moment you launch a project and say, here it is, it's archaic. And it's foolish, I think. When people say, what should I do to get in, what should we do? I say, do something, anything. Yeah, because it is, you know, developing right before our eyes. Like Jamie said, it's an accident that's happening. And you have to participate. So, before I get into some specifics of what KRN is doing, and I will try to keep this to 5 minutes, I want to give you a little theory behind it. I like what Glenn Reynolds says, that what we're experiencing is the triumph of personal technology over mass technology. And that's in his book, An Army of David's, recommended reading. So I'm going to talk about this in that context. And what we have is a classic business disruption, where personal technology is disrupting the business of mass technology. Just for grins here, think the blue circle as Kodak and the green circle as digital photography. Thousands of jobs later, and entire management change, the company finally embraced digital photography and are doing well. But it almost cost that company everything. So the reality of any business disruption, and this is what people don't want to hear, is that the business models and where you're going to find prosperity is within the disruption, not in your old model. And asking broadcasters to embrace personal technology is, like I said, it's very counterintuitive. There are two important value propositions in this. And if you take away nothing from this, take these away. Media is unbundled at the point of origin and rebundled at the point of consumption. Most broadcasters get the unbundled idea at the point of origin. And you see a lot of that now with the networks. I mean, they're offering programs or portions of programs available for download. So they're unbundling themselves, which I wholeheartedly endorse. But if that's all you do, you are setting yourself up for problems in the future. You're going to be only a content provider. And that, to me, is suicide, because the real value is at the opposite end. It's in developing businesses and models that help people rebundle material, regardless of where it comes from, for their own consumption. And local media is completely ignorant of this fact. And so that's kind of my Johnny Appleseed mission. The second value proposition is that mediated people, and who today in America isn't mediated, make their own media. So those are the two value propositions. If you can get your arms around those, you can do business in the green circle. A friend of mine, Gordon Burrell, has this wonderful statement, and he doesn't mind it, I steal it. He says, and being from Tennessee, I like these little, you know, metaphors here. So he says, the deer now have guns. And in looking at this whole personal media revolution. So what do you do when the deer have guns? You get into the ammunition business. And that is profound, and that's what I'm trying to tell clients to do, is to get into the ammunition business. All right, WKRN, the strategy of WKRN has evolved. Again, we just started doing things, and from that, things have evolved. The station operates 15 websites, including two aggregators, a paid search site, and a lot of blogs, in addition to their main website. They have plans to build to within the next few months to introduce a branded desktop reader, a screensaver, and a start page aggregator for the local community. Obviously, our strategy is designed to work with the new kids in town, not necessarily old boys. And so we have gone to great lengths to understand how these kinds of things work and how we can best position ourselves within that. And, of course, that leads everybody to WKRN.com, which is now enjoying very robust traffic, to say the least. Nashville is Talking is a local aggregator of the blogosphere, and it has three valuable functions. Nashville is Talking maintains an active blogosphere database. We started a year ago with 50 blogs. There are now over 400 in Nashville. We add 15 to 20 to the database a week. We take the position that the blogosphere at the local level exists. It's a community. And we want to be a part of that community and do what we can to undergird it and support it. And it's helpful that somebody is maintaining a record of who those people are. The second function is that we aggregate the RSS feeds of 400 local bloggers. And turn that around to one RSS feed of what our writer thinks is the best stuff of the day. So the site is actually a two-part website, and so instead of having to subscribe to 400 RSS feeds, you can just subscribe to Nashville is Talking and get a pretty good idea of what people are talking about in the community. And the third function is that we manage an ad network for the bloggers, helping them monetize their own websites. And we gather enormous behavioral data as a result of this. And the returns for WKRN are influence, visitors, revenue, and ratings. So there's been a backdoor effect on the television station itself by participating in Nashville is Talking. This is what the site looks like. The left side is written by a gal named Brittany Gilbert, who was a waitress for 10 years, but has been blogging for like six. And everybody knows her, and she's very hip and cool. On the right side is an aggregator of 400 blogs. So Brittany's job is to read the right column and write about it in the left column. Another site the station does is NashvilleWeatherChannel.com, and this is written by the it's a part of the blogosphere, and it's written by the weather department at the TV station. And those two sites have had tremendous growth over the last 12 months, and all virally. The station really doesn't promote it, you know, a lot on the air. There's no need to. And I got other stuff I could say, but I'm going to stop right now. Okay, Chris?
Terry, thank you. That's fascinating. So much to come back to there. Like, the business model is in the disruption. We'll be back. David Liroff is the techie in charge at WGBH in Boston.
Thanks, Chris. Good morning, everybody. We will get into this more extensively in a few minutes about what is the role of public media and public broadcasting. It is not incidental to mention that GBH traces its history back to the 1830s. And the Lowell family that Chris mentioned was in those years the sponsor of public lectures for the citizens of Boston. And there is a direct, unbroken lineal timeline between those public lectures in the 1830s and the WGBH of today, except to observe that we've been in the electronic mass media business for only about a third of that history, but long enough to establish assumptions, as Terry was suggesting and as Bill was suggesting, about what it means to be in the mass communications business. Audience anonymous to the communicators, members of the audience anonymous to each other, one-way communications, and it is difficult for organizations which have been around as long as we to learn new tricks, but I am happy to report that the opportunities that we now have to engage in conversations with our many audiences are being embraced with enormous enthusiasm. But I have to say that before we write off one-way mass communications and broadcasting and rush to the new media, one of the phenomena which I don't think is receiving the attention it should be receiving is the extraordinary power of connecting broadcasting and the internet together. And there's no better way to demonstrate that than by looking at the numbers. And any of you who are online right now should check me on this. The power of search, which, as I think most of us recognize, is going to be the key determinant of how our stuff is found in this cacophonous environment, is going to be the key to connecting those to we want to serve with the content that we're creating. So you can play with me on this if you like. Go to Google and put the word evolution in the search window. At least as of an hour ago, of the 448 million hits that produced, number two was the Evolution website for the PBS WGBH series on evolution. Go to Jesus, talk about a frequently searched for term. Of the 217 million hits that will produce, number six was the website for From Jesus to Christ, which was the Frontline series that aired originally several years ago and was recently rebroadcast. Put in Pyramids, 13,300,000 hits as of this morning. Number one is the website for the NOVA program on Pyramids, out of everything that one could call up on that subject. Put in Africans, just the word Africans, 24,300,000 hits. Number one on the list as of an hour ago was the website for Africans in America, which was the series that WGBH produced for PBS distribution. And not to be overlooked, Christopher, if you put in open source in Google, you get no fewer than 1,550,000 hits. Number 24 is Radio Open Source, the website for the program that Christopher does with, in association with WGBH and PRI and UMass Lowell. Now, that's quite extraordinary, because the visibility that's gained through the broadcast distribution function, paired with the not only the potential participation, but the actual participation generated by hooking up in conversations with our viewers, is something that we have only now begun to understand and to begin to exploit. You take those capabilities and you couple them with what we can now do with on-demand, both on broadband and on cable. And we are working diligently, going back to our keynote, on securing the appropriate rights to make more flexible use of our content. And it is obviously premature to walk away from the power of the broadcast media that we are using as our primary means of distribution, but clearly opportunities to engage with our audience. If you go and look at iTunes podcasting, you will find in their top 100 podcasts on any day at least 10 from National Public Radio, along with a number from WQED, from KQED and WGBH in Boston, including Morning Stories, which is a series originally started for broadcast, now online through iTunes, free, by the way. And Morning Stories, which are just personal stories of life experiences, has now, in the few short months that it has been available online, prompted those who listen to those podcasts to create their own stories and to send them back to us. So we now have a creative community into which the catalyst has been dropped, with the GBH Morning Stories as the locus of those activities. And there are now participatory film competitions as well, including the 655 project, about which I'll say more in a moment if I have the time. So we are now podcasting for the World Technology Report, the BBC, WGBH, PRI, World Program, and NOVA, and American Experience, and others, and looking forward to more user-generated content, as Bill is suggesting, at Minnesota Public Radio. Perhaps our earliest endeavor in this area, and I mentioned the public lectures supported by the Lowell family, is a project called the Forum Network, which in fact is an online archives of lectures presented at Boston area institutions like the Museum of Science, Harvard School of Education, Kennedy Library, 30 institutions in all, where typically a lecturer or an author or an artist will do a presentation attended usually at best by several hundred people. But we now capture those lectures and presentations and organize them and curate them. This is wgbh.org/forum. And we are now continuing this legacy of public lectures, which began in the 1830s, wonderfully and deliciously funded by the Lowell Foundation, whose roots go back to those public lectures in the 1830s. One concludes after a while that there is less to do here with technology and more to do with a commitment to public service and, most significantly, to engagement of audiences, as you're hearing from Terry and from Bill and from me this morning. And as Pat Afterheide at the Center for Social Media at American University has observed, the key to public media going forward may well be this issue of engagement, to create a more active and engaged citizenry for the improvement of democracy. Because as we heard this morning, it is dangerous to assume that the for-profit free enterprise system will worry about assuring an engaged and active citizenry. And I have to think that when the media barons of the country get up in the morning, the first thing on their minds is not how do we better serve the public interest. That's not their job, and that is the job of these public media organizations. So we're now looking at these technologies as enablers of participation and engagement. We're working on a program about Native American life and history in the U.S. called We Shall Remain, and one of the components of that that we're working on is how to use cell phones to allow the to facilitate the involvement of the very people about whom this program is being produced to assure that it's not just a one-way, top-down version of their life stories in this country. We're also working with the Open Media Network, of which you may be aware, Mike Homer's project to provide a home for public media on the internet, omn.org. But underlying all of this is a fundamental premise which traces back to the 1970s at WGBH that these media have to be made accessible to those who, due to physical limitations such as vision impairment or hearing impairment, otherwise would be denied full access and participation in these opportunities. The National Center for Accessible Media at WGBH, whose roots go back to the creation of captioning for broadcast television in the 70s, continues its work in developing and defining standards for these new media. And that's NCAM, National Center for Accessible Media. And we cannot miss our obligation to engage those audiences as well and to provide access to them. Anyway, to wrap, Andy Grove of Intel wrote a book called Only the Paranoid Survive, with which you may be familiar, and coined the phrase, and I hadn't seen it elsewhere, the strategic inflection point, which is that point in the life of a corporation or an institution or an individual where fewer and fewer of the old rules apply. This is analogous to letting go of the last vine before the new one presents itself. But the new rules haven't been written yet. And you are essentially, to use the vine analogy, in free fall, not knowing exactly what the new rules are going to be. And that certainly defines where all of our media organizations are these days. But this is not just about morphing our way from what for broadcasters has been a geographically based market to one in which we have communities of interest, some of which are geographically defined, some of them of which are defined by their mutual interests. Chris and I have discussed on previous occasions the apparent emergence of what Desjardins referred to as a global consciousness, now more than 50 years ago, the notion of interconnectedness of everybody all at the same time. And when you drill down not very far beneath that notion, you come to the realization that all of our institutions, all of our governments, all of our organized life in civilization is premised on the idea that geographic distance prevents interpersonal communication. That's where representative democracy comes from. That's where you have local, regional, state, national organizations. So if you removed one factor, that is that geographic distance does not prevent interpersonal communication, we haven't yet begun to see what the consequences of that phenomenon will be, what will the next 10 years look like. My colleague from WNET, Ken Devine, advises our colleagues in public broadcasting, quote, that we're not going to broadcast our ways out of this one. That the notion of denying all of this stuff is not going to be a particularly constructive approach to it. And I have to share with you one brief story on my own organization that suggests that even we, the dinosaurs that we used to be, can learn. our jazz hosts have started writing a jazz blog, which you can find at wgbh.org. And the folks who are normally responsible for the vetting of all of the official language that goes out of the organization were horrified at the notion that we would give these guys, and they're all guys, direct access to their listeners without having their prose vetted by the experts. And I observed that each night they sit down in front of a microphone which is connected to a 100,000-watt transmitter on Great Blue Hill, hence GBH, for those of you who are curious. And they communicate not only with most of New England, but also online with a global audience. And that very quickly quelled the concerns about how can we close the door here and make sure we vet everything that they say. But as I said, there is an enthusiastic embrace of these new opportunities in most quarters of the organization and an enormous amount of excitement about what's going on. I'll stop there, Chris.
Thank you.
I want to leave time for questions and thoughts from the audience, but may I just say quickly to the panel that I worry when white guys of our vintage start talking about these things or institutions start practicing in the new world that we're still looking for little windows where we can let just a tiny bit of that air in, when in fact the world is being remade by the Craigslist out of nowhere, and Daily Kos and Arianna Huffington. She had a few advantages that not all of us have, but it's being made much, much faster. I look at the New York Times every day and I think, you know, online, they're basically telling you, you know, you've seen us in print and now, praise God, you can see us on your computer, but they don't even begin to take part in the Global Voices Online premise, which is that the world is talking, are you listening, and they can speak for themselves, thank you very much. Or even the Dan Gilmore premise. I mean, think of, you know, if the audience knows more than the editors and the reporters, it's nowhere more true than in the New York Times, where, you know, the top bankers, diplomats, teachers, everybody out there is reading the New York Times. If they could only talk to the New York Times in something other than the letter column, we don't really, I don't think we've even begun to admit that the world has changed that profoundly. Terry, I'd love you to just go on for one moment about what would it actually mean to reorder our good old worlds on the premise that the answer is out there. It's not in anything we've ever done before, but it's in, maybe, if it's anywhere, it's in Craigslist or that sort of enterprise.
That's... like Jamie said, that nobody can predict the future. Not really. I just what I tell everybody is that first of all, nobody has a blueprint. Nobody says if you do this, this will happen, and then this will happen, and this will happen, which is what the business world frankly wants. It's a remarkable time of creativity and opportunity if people will just do something and get involved. I appreciate David's story about the blog because, you know, I've been going through that everywhere I go. It's like, oh, my God, you're going to let them just say what they want to say? Well, yeah. And it's amazing what happens. So, you know, I wanted to talk about your initial question was, is the internet the new public? And I think absolutely it is. Absolutely. And the public is just, you know, one thing I find is that the public is much smarter than the institutions of our world give them credit for being. And they've known it for a long time. And it's amazing when I build these blog communities or help organize them in places, I'm always struck by the quality of the people. You know, these are living and breathing communities made up of just remarkable human beings. And I say this, that people who write because they have something to say are vastly different than people who are paid to say something.
Amen.
And they're vastly more interesting, and frankly, you know, I'm drawn to that. And I think that, yes, it is the new public. I mean, and I think anybody who says that they have the public interests, you know, that they're guarding or protecting the public interests is self-deceived, because, you know, you're making up your mind what that is somewhere along the way. And I don't mean to belittle public broadcasting whatsoever, because I'm a big fan. But I think listening, again, to the public is the doorway to, you know, to finding what the real public is.
Time to go to the phones.
Good morning. My name is Eric Weltman. I live here in Cambridge, and I think this is a fascinating conference. I've really enjoyed the panelists thus far. But I do want to say that if the internet is the new public, then it's virtually white, based on the looks of this room. I can't help but notice that the people here are roughly 95% white, and that all seven of the people who've spoken thus far are white men. So I question whom is talking to whom, who is getting mobilized, who is getting involved, who's getting engaged. There's obviously a familiarity with the term the digital divide, and I think we're confronting it here today, and I'd like to see that addressed.
And what should we do about it? A little sex change clinic at lunchtime or something.
Well, as my friend here pointed out, the room does seem to be fairly gender balanced. I don't necessarily have any answers, but I do think to the extent that we're portraying, again, the internet as being the new public, we're leaving out a lot of people.
Duly noted. Thank you.
Well, could there be a comment?
David, do you want to comment?
I agree that it's an issue that we have to address. We had a conference at Center for Social Media, Pat Aufderheide's operation at American University in January, and Jackie Jones of the National Black Programming Consortium was one of the participants and made the same set of observations and put it out as a challenge for all of us to try to figure out how to make this inclusive. And we need to address considerable energy to it.
I think you're asking the wrong people, frankly.
Hi. My question is for Bill. Dan Dunsky from TV Ontario, TV producer. I noticed that you said on any given story, somebody out there will know more than you. Not everybody out there, obviously, will know more, which makes the analyst function, the gatekeeper, a very important function. What qualities do you look for in that person or those people so that you can take advantage of the expertise that is out there, but obviously filtering the less than expert stuff that comes through as well?
Well, the experiment we've been doing for the last 3 years, we have young, very smart, they are journalists, these analysts as well, and they, you know a story when you know a story. You can tell when you read something, you think that person seems to know what they're talking about. Those are the ones they save and go through and find and basically ship to the reporter, and the reporter is going to still call people and talk to people, but we have in the database, you know, often where they are. We also check, have they given us good information before? Those kind of come to the top. We have lots of those because if we're in a certain area and this CEO has been very helpful on a tech story, you know, that'll come through and we'll get that right away. So the analysts, I mean, they're looking at it. Our surprise is when we started this, we thought there'd be lots of junk, and there's not junk. The big problem is there's lots of great stuff, and it's picking and choosing and really narrowing the search. 600, 900, 1,000 is much better than, you know, 10,000 because you want to get back what, you know, a certain segment of that population. But there's no there are software now to read different things, you know, read words, and you can cull it that way. But we're still looking at these things. We're still reading it. We're still talking to people. It works in Minnesota that way. Nationally, let's see, we have a bigger challenge.
Here in the front row.
Over here, actually.
Forgive me. First on the side.
Sure.
Hi, folks. I'm Jason Pramus with the Community Media and Technology Program at UMass Boston. And to the panelists, the conceit of the Internet has been that it has put the power of one-to-many communications, which has been the purview of, you know, broadcasters for these many years, into the hands of the masses, if you will, right? To my mind, it's kind of done more like given folks the power, the old power of one-to-one communications that's ratcheted it up to like one-to-few. But it seems to me that, isn't it true, I guess my question is, that broadcasters are merely jumping on the best new upstart, you know, groups that are able to do one-to-many communications through the Internet, you know, looking at the best new technology, the best new networks, buying into them or buying them out, and simply reestablishing their preeminence as the gatekeepers of one-to-many communications. I mean, so is it really democratic? Can the public really get the information that it wants out to many other people in the public, or are not the broadcasters just reasserting their preeminence in communications?
Interesting. Terry Heaton.
I think that's a spot-on observation. And, you know, I'm going to sound like a heretic here, but I'm not a huge, huge podcasting supporter. And one of the reasons is how quickly my contemporaries in the broadcasting world jumped on it. The truth is that it's a time shifted, you know, one to many model, and so, well, I think there's value in it, and I think people should be doing it. I just don't. I'm not an evangelist for that, for the very reason. And I think yes, broadcasters are searching for familiarity and comfort within something that's very unfamiliar and uncomfortable to them. But that gets back to the green and the blue circle. You know, how long are you going to sit in your blue circle and try to protect, you know, what you have, and instead get out and get among it and find the incredible opportunities? And there are so many opportunities for local broadcast, local media companies, because all of the great innovations that are taking place are happening at the global level, you know? How long will local people sit by and let Google come in and take over, you know, the local franchise? They're just going to let them do it. And they don't, you know, you don't have to. People can do it. That's what I keep saying, is it's this great opportunity. Get away from your fear. But a lot of it is, you're exactly right, and I commend you for that observation.
Thank you.
I have a question for the public broadcasting speakers. You both described that you're now relating to your viewers as a public rather than just an audience. And you described this mechanism for two-way flow. What neither of you described was any different financial relationship. Now, public radio in Minnesota, GBH in Boston may be fat, but an awful lot of public media is not. And so the question is, are you exploring new financial relationships with your audience or your public, unlike the old one, which was essentially seeking contributions and donations? Is there a different financial basis here, perhaps, to make you or make public media generally more sustainable?
Great question.
Yeah, well, Mark, it continues to be top of mind. One of the observations to be made about the public broadcasting economy today is that it is a hybrid of free over-the-air and online content delivered to users, and then opportunities for them to pay for hard copies of DVDs, books, related materials, and the like. Clearly, there appears to be an opportunity someplace in this mix for subscription services of some sort, and we are delicately experimenting with what our options might be. But it would be foolish of us, and you and I talked about this in D.C. a couple of months ago, to assume that the present model will sustain over time, particularly because it is premised on what we would euphemistically call interruption marketing for on-air fundraising, which can easily be zapped with DVRs and TiVos and similar devices. So yes, there is very active conversation to look for alternative models into which you are, as you know, enthusiastically invited. I have to make a general observation, if I may, on this question.
I think it is appropriate for all of us to simply acknowledge that we are in the very first nanoseconds of whatever this new era is about, and to start trying to write the rules now based on what is extraordinarily limited experience would be the height of arrogance. There are, however, some patterns to the earlier question. Big business will try to become bigger. They will try to dominate. There's no surprise that News Corp bought MySpace, and that is an inevitable direction in any free enterprise economy. The question is, what do those of us who care about the public interest and public service do about it? And you look at those instances, going back to our keynote this morning, about issues such as network neutrality, where you open up that door to allow the larger players to dominate the channels of communication, and you suddenly have put throttles on our ability to speak with each other. I'm struck by the sign which is said to be over the desk of the chief decision maker at MTV Networks. It's said to say, I have to check this, I'll go there. Sorry. It's coming, it's here, it's gone.
Rebecca McKinnon of Global Voices Online.
Thank you. Hi. Just wanted to continue hammering on this subject of whether
Please.
Or not the internet is the new public. Because with Global Voices Online, we've been finding that the internet and the blogosphere is the voice of the new voiced elites around the world, primarily. And I guess just pushing on this a bit more, if public media very rightly is embracing the internet and embracing the new tools for people to participate, and that increasingly the democratic civil discourse is going to really be coming from facilitated, you know, internet conversations, what obligation do you feel that public media now has to do more outreach and education in the schools, to teach people how they can use these new tools to speak out and participate? And to what extent are public media companies considering in getting very actively involved with bridging the digital divide, getting cities to provide free or very cheap internet access to underprivileged communities? How active are you being involved in that, and should you
Rebecca,
be
Rebecca, I take your question, which is basically, isn't this a responsibility to in public media to get with it? Who wants to answer for public media? David or Bill?
Rebecca, I agree. Yes, I think it is. If we're true to our commitment to engage the public as more active citizens, that's a natural consequence of that premise, and we should be doing more.
We have a huge obligation for outreach. When we did a series on immigration, we basically got groups of immigrants, and knowing the viral nature of the web, they've told other people, told other people, told other people. You know, there are lots of illegal immigrants who are online, and we got lots of them to tell us stories that became part of a series of things. When we do meetings, and we do these face-to-face meetings, we look for and get listservs and find as diverse a group as we possibly can, and those are people we want in our network. We have an obligation to do it. I'm not sure that we can go out and have cities change their, you know, internet, make it free everywhere, and I don't know that we're the lobbyists to do that, in fact. It'd be a nice thing, but not sure we can.
Could I just close it with one very big picture question or observation? It just seems to me, from where I sit, that the world is increasingly, there are two kinds of people in the world. One, I mean, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, one with the people who thought the Bush impersonator was a laugh riot, and others who thought Steve Colbert made one of the great breakthroughs of the modern world. Tim Russert had the impersonator on, and Chris Matthews with him, telling him how great he was. The rest of us keep looking at that Steve Colbert tape and imagining how in the world did he have the balls to stay on that course. Oddly enough, Steve Colbert became famous because C-SPAN, public broadcasting, was right there on it, but he took off in the web world and died in the New York Times. I guess my general question is, I mean, that's a generational difference, it's a political difference, it's an institutional difference. Where does public broadcasting want to be in these two worlds?
Before the panel answers, can I just interject for one moment? There's a few more questions out here we want to get to, and we also want to take an executive decision to go over a few minutes because it's such a
stay of execution?
Yes.
Thank you.
So maybe we could just take a couple quickly and then let these guys get their last words in and respond to these questions.
Should we answer the question and then go
like
to
the Colbert world? So
new one.
Go on.
Can we go to the questions? Because I want to.
Okay.
This is the audience.
Please.
Right here. Hi, I'm Nolan Bowie of the Kennedy School of Government. I agree with the first speaker and Rebecca in terms of speaking to the Internet as the new public. I'd like to point out that there are more people in the world who are illiterate, even in their own language, 1 billion approximately, than there are Internet users, the people who go online, which is approximately 800 million. About 50% of the world's population has still never used a telephone. 47% of American adults are basically functionally literate, reading at the lowest levels of proficiencies, levels 1 and 2. The question was raised as to what could be done about it. What could be done about it? Well, we can make access to literacy and quality education a matter of right and an enforceable right. We could provide ubiquitous broadband and universal service to the whole of the United States under one, say, wireless cloud if government were to do what it has both a moral and legal responsibility to do to make the best use of radio by reallocating, say, some of the broadcast spectrum, which is supposed to take place at the end of this year, according to the 1996 Telecom Act. I'd also like to point out that last month's issue of Mac Attic, a magazine dedicated to the future of the Macintosh, with the article, stated that within 5 years...
I hear a question trying to get out of there.
Within 5 years, that there will be a real-time translation of other languages, which offers an opportunity for broader use of the Internet. The question is, do you suggest, the panel, suggest policies to have toward ubiquitous or universal service?
Terry Heaton.
Well, I think the, you know, I'm not sure that policy is required. I mean, I think we should all be working, you know, in an ideal sense to that end. And I find that the disparities that you describe are not failures of the Internet. They're failures of the institutions, of the contemporary institutions, wherever, and that the energy that's driving, you know, this new media is a direct response to that. So I think there's a great hope. I have a new hope, anyway, that we will resolve some of these major issues, you know, if we just start talking to each other, you know? I have a son-in-law who's Palestinian, and I've gotten to know a lot of things about the world, especially in the Middle East, through him. I found that reading bloggers during the from Iraq and after the Iraq War was very edifying and educational too. And I think the day's coming when we'll have a universal translator like Star Trek, and that we will be able to talk to each other, and some of these walls that we have will come down. And so I think it's a great hope. Should we be working towards that end right now? Absolutely, wherever we can, and that individually and corporately too. So thank you.
Thank you. Two more, please, from the floor.
Sean Kuhn from People Yes. The question of changing revenue models or expanding revenue models to the audience itself. Bill, you brought up the Audience Insight Repository. I don't even want to talk necessarily about revenue itself, but just a simple concept of linking back out and building community through those links to the people that are providing that insight, instead of taking it under the cover of the database and pushing it back out through the reporter. So I want to get your ideas around that.
I'm a news guy, not as much a tech guy. I do know that when we do the idea generator, it's linking back out, and people are using that, and it generates its own, you know, use. That happens a lot in that idea generator. That's going on. We bring a database in and use it in the newsroom. That's kind of the way we've tried to develop this. The viral nature of the web is so interesting, and it's so much changing all the time. I can't tell you that this is the way it's going to always go forward. We also know when we bring people in and we do these town hall things that we've drawn on their input, they're telling other people. I mean, they're sharing all this information. They're connecting the dots that in ways we had no idea about. That's going on all the time in each of these projects. And I think it's a good thing.
Please.
Yeah, Michael Smolens from .sub. To the first question about that the internet is a male, white, dominated thing, it's absolutely not true. The entire world, the growth and penetration of the internet is much higher than it is in the United States. And the increase outside of the English language is exponentially higher than it is in the United States. And one of the major problems today is the lack of cultural sensitivity and awareness of most of the U.S.-centric business models and thinking. And we've created a technology which will be demonstrated that will allow all video and film to be subtitled in any language from a browser in real time at no cost. So I want to ask you about how you're thinking about all of your innovations relative to the world, and because the internet can be accessed by anyone in the world, as to how you're trying to view the whole world and not just the U.S.-centric nature of what we're talking about here in Cambridge today.
Good question.
What a huge question. Again, I have great faith in people, and I think that, I can't answer that question right now. You know, 20 years from now, maybe somebody will have a better idea, but I think where we can provide help is through aggregation. I just welcome this. I mean, don't you? The idea that so many people of different countries and different languages are on the same hookup. I mean, we have an innate desire to connect, don't we, as human beings? And I think that has profound ramifications for society and culture.
Terry, could I just follow up, though? I mean, the key is listening. And we have a culture and a politics at this moment, it strikes me, that doesn't want to listen, that is not in the business of, can we talk about it? Could I answer your letter? But could we have a talk about a broad agenda? That is not where our whole American profile sits these days.
I just see a growing irrelevancy for all of that. I mean, Peter Lurie wrote a brilliant essay on a few years back on how the structure of the internet will win the culture wars for the left, because it introduces people to the process of deconstruction. Just a link does, If you follow links, you are deconstructing what's right in front of you, and that cannot produce anything other than, an informed, kind of left-leaning group. So,
But that's reality.
I mean,
so Stephen Colbert wins, you mean?
Yeah.
Last word, okay. David or Bill?
Not respond directly responsive to this. I can only, somebody asked what the next 10 years are going to look like earlier today. Can you imagine what a kid born 3 weeks ago, as my first granddaughter was, is going to make of what we think of this environment, what expectations that she will bring to what's going on these days? We think we're so on top of it and so cool and so with it. Most of us, I would have to say, relatively speaking, don't have a clue. Because while we can understand these phenomena intellectually, we cannot relate to them viscerally the way kids born into this environment can today. And one way to try to address that is to engage as many younger people as is possible in all of these conversations, because their relationship to the media environment is distinctly different from those of us who are now, quote, in charge.
The next panel will be all kids, maximum age 10 years old. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.